I'm thrilled to be here, and I particularly working with the fantastic groups that organized this evening, particularly Justin Alexander from Jubilee Iraq, who picked me up at the airport this afternoon. And on the train ride back, I asked Justin what he hoped that I could accomplish tonight, because of course he's worked very, very hard to bring this evening together. And he said, "I want you to make people feel optimistic after Bush's victory." So that's how you know you're dealing with, I guess, a good activist on your hands. He aims high. He's not afraid to dream big. I'm supposed to make you feel optimistic about Bush's win. I can't do that, my friends. This is the tallest podium. It's making me feel incredibly short. It's humbling. Kind of like that request. I don't think I can do that. I don't think I can make you feel optimistic about Bush's win, but what I want to do is talk a little bit about why I think he did win and tell you a little bit about some of the mistakes we made in North America and what I think we can learn from some of these mistakes, which I don't think are really unique to the North American left, although maybe we have them in a slightly exaggerated form, as all things. So, because I think it can actually inform our activism in the future, and that should make us optimistic, that we can learn from our mistakes. Unlike the people we're up against, who are incapable of learning from their mistakes. They just think, I'll bring bigger weapons next time. So the bad news, of course you know, which is actually that Bush didn't just win the presidency, control over Congress and the Senate and the Supreme Court. He won something much more important, which is he won, and you can see it now, a new sense of total impunity. We have seen since November the 2nd, I mean, maybe you didn't think before that it was possible to have a U.S. president with a greater sense of impunity than he had before the election, but yes, it is possible because we're seeing it now. We're seeing a sort of supercharged Bush, a new defiance, a new swagger in his swagger, chock full of impunity-boosting vitamins and minerals. And we see this most clearly in the actions of the U.S. and also British military in Iraq. Now, it isn't new to be attacking civilian areas. It happened, has been happening for many months now, many years. But there's a way in which the attack, this latest reinvasion of Fallujah and Mosul, there's an unapologeticness to it. They're not even bothering to try to cover it up. And you saw that, I think, most dramatically with the first act, which was laying siege on the general hospital in Fallujah. They didn't try to hide it. They didn't try to deny it. They just announced that the hospital was a center of propaganda. A center of propaganda, why? Because last time they invaded Fallujah, the doctors went and told the journalists how many people had died, and they weren't going to have any of that. All the journalists this time were embedded. The ones who weren't were detained, including an Al Arabiya reporter, and as we know, Al Jazeera has been banned. So there is this new defiance, not even opening up a humanitarian corridor. No denials. So that's happening in Iraq. At home, this impunity, this new defiance, has been made official U.S. policy, most dramatically and most distressingly with Bush's announcement that he is nominating a man named Alberto Gonzalez to be the next U.S. Attorney General, which is the highest legal office in the land. Ashcroft is gone. in comes Alberto Gonzalez. Now, Alberto Gonzalez, as many of you know, is the man who wrote the infamous torture memo advising the president personally that the Geneva Conventions do not apply in the treatment of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror. So this is a man who advised the president to ignore the Geneva Conventions. He called them obsolete and quaint. And now he is being promoted to the highest legal office in the land. That's what I mean by a new impunity, and we have to understand what we're up against, and we need to develop strategies, I believe, to really surround this new adventurism. And I think Britain has a very powerful role to play in that, as do all the countries that have sent troops to Iraq. Because what we're seeing is that they're spread very, very thinly. I mean, this is one thing that we're seeing with the fact that the invasion of Fallujah has led to outbreaks of violence across the country. They actually do not have enough troops to cover the country. And I think one of the main reasons why Bush was reelected is because the war continues to be isolated. Americans continue to feel themselves to be isolated from the war, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. But one of the reasons for that is that they don't have a draft. And there are a few things standing between the U.S. and a draft. And one of those is Britain, another is Italy, another is Poland, another are the 20,000 mercenary soldiers. But they're getting closer and closer to having to bring a draft to the U.S. And when they do bring a draft to the U.S., and I think they will have to, then the war becomes very, very real for Americans. And I say this as the daughter of a draft dodger. My family came to Canada during the Vietnam War. Many American war resistors did the same. And, in fact, in Canada now, where I live, we are trying to build a movement to grant refugee status to American war resistors. We have three right now who are trying to seek refugee status on the ground that the war is illegal. And I think that if, on the one hand, their coalition continues to break apart and there is a mutiny within the coalition, we've just seen Hungary announce that they're going to pull out. We're up to 12 countries now either having pulled out or announced that they are going to pull out. So on the one hand, if you have the coalition falling apart, and on the other hand, you have actually the ability of those who are drafted, those who don't want to fight, to desert or defect, then I think that you will start to feel the pressure more in the U.S. Now, there's something there's a face of this new American impunity for me that really, really sums up what we're dealing with. And I don't know how much you've heard about this here in the UK, but there's a Marine named James Blake Miller who has been called the Marlboro Marine. Have you heard about this guy? He's a sort of celebrity of the war in Iraq right now. He's a good-looking guy who had his picture taken by an LA Times photographer on the second day of the latest siege of Fallujah. His face is covered in war paint. It's smudged. And he has a cut on his nose. It's kind of bloody. And he's got this sort of steely-eyed stare looking off into the distance. And he's got a freshly lit Marlboro cigarette hanging from his lips. And this image has been reprinted in more than 100 newspapers in the United States, usually on the cover. The most dramatic cover was the cover of the New York Post. It was a huge close-up of the Marlboro Marine, and it said, "Smoking, Marlboro men kick butt in Fallujah." And this man, this young man, not his fault, he was just having a cigarette, as he said. He actually doesn't seem too thrilled to be serving. He says he's not going to re-enlist. He said, "I signed the papers, I gotta go." That's his attitude towards the war. Nevertheless, he has become this receptacle of love for a great many Americans, and including women who have been writing him love letters. And including quite a few people who he's complained. The one thing he asked for when he was interviewed about his newfound fame, he asked for more cigarettes. He said he only has 4 packs left. And he apparently smokes 3 packs a day. And he wants more cigarettes, so people have been trying to send Marlboros to Fallujah. They're apparently unaware that FedEx doesn't deliver to Fallujah. In fact, they've closed the airport. Nevertheless, they're sending Marlboros to Fallujah. And so it's women love this guy. Men do as well. In fact, Dan Rather, very famous American newsman, I realize that you don't get CBS News, but you probably heard about Rathergate, Memogate, during the election. And because of this, Dan Rather's patriotism was questioned. And, you know, if you're a U.S. newscaster on a major network, you really don't like that. So Dan Rather has been trying to prove to his viewers that he is indeed a patriot. And he has latched on to poor Mr. Miller to do this. And he has done several segments where he just stares at this photograph and just waxes poetic about how wonderful this man is who he's never met. And at one point he said, "For me, this one's personal. This is a warrior with his eyes on the far horizon, scanning for danger. See it, study it, absorb it, think about it. Then take a deep breath of pride. And if your eyes don't dampen, you're a better man or woman than I." This is American news for you. Then he brought his mother on and interviewed her and so on. And they keep using this word, iconic. It's an iconic image. Now, it's in fact not an iconic image. It's the most derivative image you can imagine. What it is a direct ripoff of the most ubiquitous and powerful symbol ever created by Madison Avenue, which is the Marlboro Man, who was in turn ripping off the most powerful star ever created by Hollywood, John Wayne, who in turn was channeling the most powerful American myth, which is the myth of the cowboy on the rugged frontier. But anyway, they believe that it is iconic. It's like when you hear a song and you feel like you've heard it 1,000 times, because you've heard it 1,000 times. Anyway. So they call this guy the face of Fallujah. And to me that's striking because, of course, in the rest of the world, there's another Marine who is, in fact, the face of Fallujah, and it is not young James Blake Miller. It is the unnamed Marine who was caught on video by NBC executing an unarmed, prone Iraqi prisoner who may or may not have been a fighter in a mosque. That is the face of Fallujah for the rest of the world. So there is this powerful disconnect between the way Americans are seeing themselves and the war and the way the rest of the world are seeing them. And I really see that summarized by these two faces of Fallujah. One, the Marine in the mosque. The other, the Marlboro Marine who is being held up. And with ever greater desperation, really, the more this disturbing information comes out about what is really going on, the more desperately the American public and the media seems to be clinging to this most hackneyed of myths, the John Wayne in Fallujah. And of course it is fitting that they chose this cowboy soldier because they've just re-elected this cowboy president, which we saw a little of in Santiago, Chile, during the APEC conference, where Bush reached in and grabbed his bodyguards and pulled them across the security line, which is, you know, a very physical way of saying, you know, your security laws do not apply to America. Because, of course, they had a rule, which was that nobody with guns was allowed into the state dinner. So that was sort of also kind of a metaphor for the new impunity. And they had dressed him in a poncho. I think that was the issue. He's like, "You can dress me like an Indian, but I'm still a cowboy." So back to the Marlboro Marine. It gets worse, and here's where it gets worse. It's ignited a controversy, though not the controversy that one would expect about using classic propaganda techniques to romanticize war crimes. No, that's not the controversy. The controversy is this. I'll read you a letter to the editor that was written to the Houston Chronicle. Lots of children, particularly boys, play army and like to imitate this young man. The clear message of the photo is that the way to relax after battle is with a cigarette. And then somebody else wrote a letter to the Dallas newspaper saying, are there no photos of non-smoking soldiers? And a letter writer to the New York Post actually provided some suggestions for more politically correct propaganda images. He says, maybe showing a Marine drinking water would have a more positive impact on your readers. So these letter writers from across the country were united in their sense of outrage that it would be much healthier to take a break from killing by having water. I mean, they also don't know that there's a severe water shortage in Iraq, so maybe it should be a Coke. He should have a Coke if you're really going to go with the all-American imagery here. So let's be clear. The problem is not that this steely-eyed, smoking soldier makes mass killing look cool. The problem is that the otherwise laudable act of mass killing is making smoking look cool. Smoking is obviously more of a problem than killing. The problem with killing is, in fact, that it could lead to smoking. And that, you know, when American parents buy war toys for their children, they're going to have to start getting them plastic Marlboros, and nobody wants them. It actually reminds me of a bit of a risque joke. And I'm going to try to tell it to you, which is, some of you may know this joke. It's about a Hasidic rabbi. He's counseling some newlyweds who come into his chamber's office for sexual advice. And they're asking him what are acceptable sexual practices under Jewish law, under Hasidic Jewish law. And they have questions. They've never done it before. And so they say, well, is it okay if we do the missionary position? And the rabbi says, of course, you're man and wife. You know, you're continuing the human race, of course. It's a celebration of love. Go for it. And they say, okay. And they suggest a couple more, maybe a little bit riskier sexual positions. And he says, yes, go, you know, you have my blessing. And they say, okay. How about standing up? And he says, no. That could lead to dancing. Okay. So, it could also lead to smoking. So that's what it's come to. It's a country bickering about the ethics of smoking while Iraq burns. And I want to be honest with you that in the U.S. press, certainly in the mainstream press, the debate about the ethics of bombing civilian areas, of laying siege on hospitals, of bombing emergency health clinics, this debate is not taking place. Even less than it is taking place here, which is not very much. The blame for that, I don't believe, rests with Bush alone. It also rests with his opponents, principally his main opponent, John Kerry, and the Kerry campaign, but also with the broader anti-war movement in North America. But I don't think it's only the North American anti-war movement that has suffered from some of these problems. So I just want to outline some of what went wrong during the election campaign. There was this very odd phenomenon where we were told over and over again that the election was going to be fought over Iraq, that Iraq was going to be the central issue, that this is what all the polls were saying Americans cared about. And in fact, it was true. Americans did care very much about the war. And there was talk at first of the war, but it was mostly Vietnam. Then there was much more talk of Swift boats and John Kerry than there was talking about warships over Najaf, which was in the middle of the campaign. And there was, but even when they did talk about Iraq, it was usually in the past tense. It was really, Kerry's points were mostly about whether Bush lied, who knew what when. It was not about what was going on in Iraq in the present tense, or perhaps it was Bush wanting to focus attention into the future, about how it was going to be this wonderful beacon of democracy for all of the Middle East. But nobody wanted to talk about Iraq now. Nobody wants to talk about the reality on the ground. And I was in New York City during the Republican National Convention at the end of August, during the RNC, where there were 500,000 people who participated in what was billed as an anti-war demonstration. But I was at that anti-war demonstration. It was much more an anti-Bush demonstration. The slogan was "No to the Bush Agenda," and there were some "No to War" banners. But it also lacked specificity, especially because while we were marching, Najaf was under siege, and much of the rest of the world was horrified by the desecration of cemeteries, of the most sacred mosque, and the shrine of Imam Ali, and that was just absent. I think that there was a fear, and I talked about this with some of the organizers of the demonstration, there was a fear of not wanting to get into specifics because maybe that would seem that you were for the resistance, maybe it would seem like you were pro-terrorist. Better to just say, you know, bring the troops home, no to the Bush agenda, and these sort of general slogans. The other issue was that there was a perception, it's a very powerful perception, that Americans really only care about their own. So you could talk about U.S. soldiers and how they needed more body armor, and you could talk about how at that point 1,000 U.S. soldiers had died, but you didn't want to make too big a deal about the fact that at that point the estimates were that 30,000 Iraqis had died. So there was even a procession in the march during the Republican National Convention of 1,000 coffins to represent the soldiers, but there was nothing representing the Iraqis who died. So it reinforced the idea, you know, these deaths don't matter, some deaths are worth more than others. The other narrative that came up again and again was Bush lied. And it cast us, really, as the victims of the war. You know, we were lied to. And it was completely, I mean, we were lied to, but the idea that we see ourselves as the victims instead of Iraqis as the victims seemed totally out of scale, and I think that has been true largely as well of the debate here in Britain in some circles, that we spend a lot of time trying to vindicate ourselves, vindicate our opposition to the war, prove that we were right again and again and again. Okay, we were right, but maybe we should move on. And also talking about it in terms of our own victimization. There's also another element that I've started to notice, which is almost a fear of talking about ways that we could work to improve the situation in Iraq. Because we, and I'm thinking of, you know, fighting for genuinely free and fair elections, debt forgiveness, reparations, concrete political demands that we need to be making now instead of going back over and over the same mistakes. I've started to detect a feeling that if we do make these demands, in some ways we're saying something good could come of this war, which is to somehow give a point to our opponents to admit that maybe the war was right. And certainly people will make that argument, but who cares? I was asked by a journalist the other day when I was saying that I do think democracy can come to Iraq if we fight for it, if we fight with Iraqis for it. And they said, well, then what you're saying is that the war, a good thing could come from the war. It's sort of like a gotcha. So what? And if that happens, it will be despite their best efforts. And I'll come back to that. So that was what the war, that was the state of the anti-war movement during the campaign. This refusal really to put forward concrete demands about the present tense in Iraq. All of these confused motivations for that. And then you had the Kerry campaign, which was gripped by this logic of so-called electability. Choose the most electable candidate. He was supposedly the most electable candidate. And then choose a strategy of issues to focus on that has absolutely nothing to do with principle, but what your pollsters and your advisors tell you are going to be your best chance of winning over undecided voters in the swing states. And that was essentially the Kerry campaign. The effect of that was that they ran an incredibly cautious campaign, very much geared towards essentially out-Marlboroing man Bush, which is impossible, cannot be done. But it also was a morally bankrupt campaign because it was based on this, on all of these truisms. Americans just are incapable of caring about anyone but themselves. They don't even bother talking about Iraqis. If you criticize anything having to do with the war beyond that Bush lied, then you are, you know, you're criticizing the troops, and you can never criticize the troops. So what we had was a campaign where the candidate, John Kerry, never mentioned Abu Ghraib, never mentioned Guantanamo Bay, never mentioned the Arab Americans being rounded up and interrogated and held without trial for the similar fears of being seen as being soft on terror. And also, when it became painfully clear that as soon as the polls closed, terror would rain down on Fallujah, Kerry never spoke out against that, never used the platform during the campaign to say this is a violation of the Geneva Convention, or actually to say anything about any of the other attacks on civilian areas in Najaf and Sadr City that were going on throughout the campaign. He also never made the argument that that torture in American-run prisons in Iraq and the attacks on civilian areas were feeding and swelling the ranks of the armed resistance faster than they could ever be suppressed. I mean, when Bush came forward with these absurd statistics like, you know, we have 75% of the terrorists, nobody was making the argument that that the ranks of the so-called terrorists were swelling with each of these attacks. And when The Lancet published its landmark study estimating that 100,000 Iraqis had died as a result of the invasion and occupation, Kerry never mentioned it again. But worse than that, he continued to repeat over and over again in all three of the debates this absolutely outrageous claim, which was that Americans are, quote, 90% of the casualties in Iraq, 90% of the casualties, when in fact the ratio is 100-1. And for me, the most absurd moment came during the vice presidential debate between Dick Cheney and John Edwards, where John Edwards repeated this claim that Americans were 90% of the casualties, and Dick Cheney interrupted him and said, well, what about all the Iraqi soldiers? So it was left to Dick Cheney to point out that there were some Iraqis taking a few hits as well. Now, when it became clear that we had a pro-war candidate, not just not an anti-war candidate, but a major pro-war candidate, who was essentially saying, I'll fight the war better, I'll be a better administrator of the war, the anti-war movement should have been in the streets. And I think that this is compatible with saying, yes, we want Bush out. You know, I certainly felt that way, and I definitely think it would have been better had Bush lost. But that said, the anti-war movement could have been in the streets the whole time, making these arguments the whole time, using the platform that is created by an electoral campaign to force these issues onto the agenda. Instead, what they were doing mostly was either staying quiet until November 3rd, which I was told to do many times. Yes, that's a very good point. Let's talk about it on November the 3rd, after Kerry wins. Or they were signing up voters for Kerry. Now, this was a serious mistake, and it was a mistake on a couple of major levels. The one is, of course, that it was morally bankrupt, and that the left and progressives in the U.S., not all of them, but many of them, became deeply complicit in the dehumanization of Iraqis, that is, in fact, what allows, what creates the climate and the culture that allows for these war crimes to be committed. It is the dehumanization of the other. And by having parades of 1,000 coffins, by not challenging Kerry when he said 90% of the casualties, we were complicit in that dehumanization. And it also sent a message, a very clear message, received by the Bush administration, that you can commit war crimes and pay absolutely no political price. I mean, we know that they don't pay a political price on the world stage, but they could have paid a political price domestically, and they did not. They got a kind of a get out of the Geneva Conventions free card. And I think the other issue is that it didn't work, right? I mean, the idea that this was in fact a strategy of electability turns out to be wrong. And we will never know whether a genuine anti-war candidate that spoke in the language of morality, that spoke for the value of human lives, that said to the Bush campaign, how dare you call yourself pro-life as you defend stem cells when 100,000 Iraqis have died. There could have been a language of morality in this campaign to answer the language of faith, and there was not. There was this, I'm a better bureaucrat of the war than you. And it didn't work. So you end up with the worst of both worlds. One, Bush, for 4 more years. But two, this culture of impunity, this supercharged Bush who has gotten this message that you can commit these crimes and pay no political price. So that is where we went seriously wrong in North America. We lost sight of why we were fighting the war, why we were against the war. We focused on this single man, on this politics of personality. We poured everything into the idea of we just have to get this guy out, and lost sight of all the reasons why that was true, and lost everything for it, lost the election, lost the moral ground. So we need to change that. I think what we need to really start wrestling with is how you transform an anti-war movement into a pro-democracy movement. How we become the voices demanding genuine democracy, genuine liberation for Iraq, liberation and democracy that our leaders have promised, that they never meant, promises they never meant to keep, but promises they made and continue to make nonetheless. And these are our demands that people in Iraq are risking their lives, losing their lives to make, and I'm going to come back to that in a little bit more detail. But I think that that means that we have ever more responsibility to bring those demands to where the decisions are actually being made, which is not in Iraq, because it continues to be an occupied country, but in Washington and in London. Now, I also want to talk a little bit about vanguardism in our movement, because I described this sort of unwillingness to talk about the siege on Najaf during the Republican National Convention, but there was also something else that, and I think we need to be very careful about that vanguardist attitude that celebrates any failure of American or British imperial projects and doesn't look at what it's actually like to live under that terror, to be caught in that terror, which is why I am so pleased to be here tonight at a fundraiser organized by Jubilee Iraq, by Iraq Occupation Focus, by War on Want, by Voices in the Wilderness, because these are groups that have stayed focused consistently on the material demands to bring real liberation to Iraq, acts of concrete, non-imperialist solidarity devised in constant consultation with Iraqis. Now, the demands that we're hearing from these groups and that I hope that we're all here to support, these are the groups that demanded, during the Saddam years, freedom from dictatorship and freedom from the sanctions. And after the invasion, freedom from occupation, but also freedom from debt and the economic colonization that is so much a part of this project, which I was supposed to talk a lot about tonight, but I ended up talking more about the election. Now, that is what it means to actually fight for democracy, genuine democracy, a meaningful democracy that means the ability of a people to be the architect of their destiny, because we know how you can have rituals of democracy, that become meaningless because all of the decisions are already being made by the International Monetary Fund, the deals have already been signed, and so many liberation movements, powerful liberation movements, have been betrayed in precisely this way, in these moments of transition in apartheid South Africa, where you have the most powerful liberation movement of modern times, so many people who died in that struggle. But in that transition moment, some key deals were made for what's called economic continuity. And that means that the people who were oppressed under apartheid had to inherit the debts of the apartheid regime, that they had to keep the same head of the central bank. The same thing happened in Argentina, where you had a brutal military dictatorship that disappeared 30,000 people. But in that transition to democracy, they were forced to inherit the debts of the a debt that was accumulated buying weapons to use against them, to build concentration camps where they were disappeared, where their people were disappeared. And yet they had to agree in those moments to inherit that debt. That's how democracy is enslaved. And people eventually lose faith because they have freedom, but they don't have water. They have freedom, but they don't have land. They have freedom, but they don't have life. And this is what is going on in Iraq right now. You may have heard that there's been a major, wonderful victory for Iraq's debt. The headlines, you know, were that 80% of Iraq's debt has been, quote unquote, forgiven. In fact, what happened, and I'll just read you a quote from the Associated Press story. This is just a couple of days ago. The Paris Club agreed to write off 30% of the debt that they held immediately of Iraq's debt. Another 30% will be canceled after Iraq agrees on a reform program with the International Monetary Fund, expected in 2005. The third and final portion, representing 20% of Iraq's debt to the Paris Club, will be canceled in 2008 once Iraq has completed its three-year International Monetary Fund program. So this is the old story. And this is why this is the moment, and there's no time to waste, to actually be that pro-democracy movement, a meaningful pro-democracy movement, because we understand that democracy is so much more than the charade that is being planned for January 30th in Iraq, where they're literally bombing them with ballots. This debt deal that we've just seen signed with the Paris Club, of course, puts the lie on paper to the central claim of the invasion and the occupation, which was that this was ever about democracy and liberation. The fact is that the occupiers of Iraq have undermined, suppressed, subverted, repressed expressions of genuine liberation and demands for real democracy at every turn. And it's these acts, more than any other, that explain why Iraq is at this desperate moment now, so consumed by violence. Because when Iraqis have taken their occupiers at their word, this word that they were actually here to bring freedom and democracy, and demanded the right to govern themselves, they have faced brutal repression, which is why we need to support those freedoms here, because we actually continue to have those freedoms. I want to give you a few examples of what I'm talking about. Fallujah, where there's been so much attention focused. We hear that the reason why there's so much violence in Fallujah is because it was a Ba'athist holdout, that there were all of these Saddam loyalists who were determined to fight for a return to the good old days of Saddam's reign and have been fighting since the beginning. In fact, that's not the case. So there was no armed resistance in Fallujah after Baghdad fell. In the first few weeks, there was a tense calm in that city, but there was no armed resistance. It started on April the 28th, after the fall of Baghdad, because the U.S. soldiers in Fallujah had occupied the local school, and they set up a military base in the school, and students couldn't study. So a group of parents decided that they were going to exercise their newfound freedom and democracy, and they organized a demonstration. And they marched to the school, and they demanded that the soldiers withdraw, not from Iraq, from the school, so that they could send their children to school. And according to The Guardian, and this is a quote, U.S. troops opened fire and killed 13 people, wounding 75 others. A few days later, they had a demonstration against the repression because they still somehow had faith in this promise. And it happened again. Two more people were killed, fired upon. And it was only after these incidents that the first roadside bombs exploded in Fallujah, the first improvised explosive devices. When I was in Iraq in March and April, I heard dozens of these stories of small betrayals, small and large betrayals, about how people lost faith in the promise of democracy one bullet at a time. And I'm not saying that there weren't Baathist holdouts, that there weren't people who did want to return to a time when they were the elite and they had control, but they were isolated. And what has happened is those pockets of resistance have turned into a popular uprising, and it has happened through the systematic betrayal of the promise of democracy and liberation. The saddest story I heard actually involved voices in the wilderness. I met an Iraqi activist who told me that that he'd been given a tape by some activists on a Voices in the Wilderness delegation. It was a videotape of the history of nonviolence, of nonviolent resistance. And he was so excited by it. It was Gandhi to Martin Luther King. It was how do you stage a general strike? How do you do a petition? I mean, this was new. This was new to someone who grew up under dictatorship. All of these tactics, all of these ways that throughout history people have changed their destinies through nonviolent direct action. He made 100 copies of that tape, and he distributed it to everybody he knew. And it was particularly popular in his hometown of Hilla, which is between Baghdad and Najaf. And it was particularly popular because in Hilla they were having a problem, which was that the American occupiers had set up a local council, but they had appointed a very high-level Baathist general to head the council, somebody who they all knew as a killer during Saddam's time, who had a lot of blood on his hands. And so they thought, we're going to use these tactics from this video. We're going to try them. And they staged petitions, and they had sit-ins, and they occupied the city council. And they had a general strike. And they were violently repressed, and they were shot at, and their leaders were taken to Abu Ghraib and tortured. This is how the armed resistance spread in Iraq. I was in Baghdad when orders came on down from above to get rid of Muqtada al-Sadr. When I arrived in Iraq, Sadr was the most vocal critic of the handover plan. He was the most vocal critic of these unappointed councils. He was the most vocal critic of the American-drafted interim constitution. I went to hear him at his mosque in Kufa, and he called the interim constitution a terrorist law. He was not calling for armed resistance against the occupation. He was criticizing the resistance and calling for dissent in his newspaper. They were having demonstrations, they were in the streets, but they were nonviolent. Then this order came down, get rid of Sadr. The first thing they did is they sent, Paul Bremer sent armed guard soldiers to his newspaper office, and they shut down his newspaper. Next day, they arrested one of his key deputies. They issued a warrant for his arrest, for Sadr's arrest. They surrounded his home. They surrounded the mosque. There were demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations outside the so-called green zone. And they were fired upon. And two Sadr supporters were killed. This was the day after they had a large protest against the closing of the newspaper. And it was only after that that the order came down from Sadr's office. He said, I'm not going to tell you to go to protest anymore. I won't send my people to be slaughtered. And it was then that it became an armed resistance against the occupation. So this is how faith was eroded. And I don't think, that's why I don't think our role here is just to celebrate armed resistance. We need to understand that armed resistance emerges, and Iraqis are caught in the crossfire between armed actors. It emerges when democracy is betrayed. It emerges when peaceful means of resistance, when newspapers are shut down, when peaceful demonstrations are fired on. So if we have a role to play, it's not just to cheerlead the resistance. Yes, they have a right to resist. But our job is to demand democracy because we have that privilege. And that's why it's our responsibility, because it's also our governance. So the reason why these expressions of liberation have been so brutally repressed in Iraq is because genuine freedom for Iraqis was always antithetical to the real aims of the occupation. They were always at odds. They were never going to be compatible, and they never will be compatible. And we saw this from the very beginning of Paul Bremer's time in Iraq. It became really clear that this was going to be more than an occupation. They were going to turn Iraq into a kind of laboratory for the most radical forms of free market economics. And De La Piero, the wonderful historian who's based in Britain, talks about the year zeroists, the year zero camp in the Bush administration, working with Ahmad Shalabi, who envisioned the reconstruction of Iraq as a kind of a neoconservative rapture. He uses the phrase year zero because their idea was that Iraq wasn't being just invaded, it was being erased, and they were going to start over. And this was exciting, as all believers in apocalypse understand. It is redemption through violence. It is a cleansing through fire. It is not death, it is rebirth. That is what they believed. So while the rest of the world saw death, they saw birth. They saw a country being reborn through the nucleus that was the Ministry of Oil, the only site that they protected. Meanwhile, a completely sanguine attitude as Baghdad was burned by looters. Donald Rumsfeld said, free people do bad stuff, because they were in the grips of this apocalyptic fervor. And Paul Bremer, when he arrived in Baghdad, he said the city was still on fire. But he didn't wait for the fires to be extinguished before his first major act in office. A week after his arrival, he fired 500,000 people. 400 of them were soldiers. He let them keep their guns. That was helpful. Many of them were just simply state workers. They called it de-Ba'athification, but what it was an all-out attack on the state. They closed ministries wholesale. There was this kind of merger of this idea of de-Ba'athification with this neoconservative hatred of anything in the public sector. And they became one. Next thing he did is he went to a conference in Amman, a World Economic Forum conference, actually, and he announced that they were going to privatize 200 of Iraq's state-owned companies, all of Iraq's state-owned companies. Everything but the natural resource sector would be for sale immediately. He also flung open the borders to absolutely unrestricted imports. I was in Baghdad for a month before I saw a single crane. And what it was doing was not rebuilding anything. It was hoisting a billboard to advertise imported honey from Saudi Arabia, which was the same idea. Why rebuild the country when you can just buy it new from foreign corporations? That was the attitude. Then Paul Bremer wrote a series of laws. This was in September, just a few months after the invasion. A series of radical laws that the Economist magazine described as a capitalist dream, the wish list for foreign investors. It was everything that these guys lobby for at the World Trade Organization, at the International Monetary Fund, at home, in Britain, and the US, but they never actually get all at once because there are always these annoying people in the way. Trade unions, environmentalists, and opposition parties, and all these people who are getting in the way. Or if they're in a third world country, they have to deal with these local governments. But in Iraq, they were the government. They didn't have to arm wrestle anyone. They just dreamed it up inside the green zone. And they wrote all these laws. They passed them all at once. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, said it was a more radical form of shock therapy than the former Soviet Union experienced. The most radical form of shock therapy, in fact, that the world had ever seen. It allowed for 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi assets. You could take 100% of your profits out of the country. A 15% flat tax. When Iraqis complained about this to Michael Fleischer, who was the guy in charge of what's called private sector development in Iraq, he had no diplomatic experience, but he was a corporate turnaround specialist. So he said, you know, he could do this. And they had a meeting with Michael Fleischer, Ari Fleischer's brother. And they said, we're worried. How are we going to compete with all these foreign multinationals that are going to come flooding into the country? And we've been living under sanctions for 13 years. We haven't been able to get a spare part in 10 years. How are we supposed to compete? We don't even have electricity. And he said, only the best of you will survive. And then he said, the entire Republican Party is envious of your tax law, which is an admission that this was an ideological project, that they were doing in Iraq what they couldn't do at home because of this problem of people, because this project is antithetical to the idea of citizen participation. Because if we think about what animates our democracies at home. I mean, in my country, every election campaign is about whether or not we're going to preserve our public health care system, whether or not we're going to maintain any energy sovereignty and water sovereignty from the United States. It's not just about voting. It is about these core questions. And the goal of the occupation and all of its actions was to lock in all of these key decisions as fast as they possibly could, so that by the time Iraqis finally got to vote, there would be nothing left to vote for. All of the key decisions would have already been made. This theory is the theory of shock therapy. There's a reason it's called shock therapy. And the reason for that is that it's borrowed from the language of physical torture. And torturers believe, when they're interrogating prisoners, that if they shock the body in various places simultaneously, the mind becomes confused and can no longer, it breaks down the ability to resist. There's actually a CIA manual from 1963, declassified, that talks about the state of suspended animation that sets in when a prisoner has been shocked repeatedly. It breaks down the ability to resist. The same theory holds for economic shock therapy. That's why they use the same word. The idea is that the body politic responds in the same way as the physical body, which is that you're getting attacked from so many different places at once that you go into a state of shock and you can't resist. I mean, if you just have an attack on the healthcare system, you can fight that. But if you're having the minimum wage attack, the healthcare system, the education system, and the subways are being privatized, then you just get really confused and you actually can't organize an effective resistance. So that is a theory of economic shock therapy. There's a blog written by an Iraqi woman who called herself Riverbend. And she got an email a few weeks ago from somebody who asked about the growing drug problem in Baghdad. And there is a huge drug problem. People are becoming addicted to Valium in particular. And they said, well, you know, how are people responding to this? And she wrote in her blog, she said, you know, I know it's a problem. We know it's a problem. It's going to be a problem down the road. But it's like discovering that you have cancer while you're being attacked by an alligator. You'll worry about it later. That is the whole point of enforcing shock therapy, all of these reforms at once, immediately after a shock and awe military attack. You're worried about whether you're going to be able to get water, not whether your water system is going to be privatized by Bechtel. That was the point. Now, that it worked at first. The Iraqis were focused on the day-to-day concerns in those first few months. But that began to change in the fall. And those soldiers, those 400,000 soldiers who were laid off, not given their promised pensions, but allowed to keep their guns, many of them went to the arms of the resistance. In fact, Hussein Kuba, a prominent Iraqi business person, he calls it Iraqi resistance alternative employment. Because, of course, at the same time, the reconstruction of Iraq was being treated as basically goodies for the countries that invaded Iraq, not as a sort of a New Deal project for Iraqis to rebuild their country. So foreign workers were flooding in, and Iraqi unemployment was reaching 70%. So that's how the armed resistance became alternative employment. The business people, who were told how lucky they are that they get to have a 15% flat tax, many of them funded the resistance because they realized that they weren't going to be able to compete in this new environment and out of their sense of self-preservation. You know, we hear all the money must be coming from Syria, must be coming from Iran. A lot of the money is actually coming from inside Iraq. So these were the betrayals. But there was a larger sort of rebellion that took place when it became clear that these privatizations were going to be enormously unpopular. There was a problem with the plan to sell off Iraq state companies. I'm not going to get into it in too much detail. It's something I've written about a lot. And I think it's something that people understand now somewhat, which is that it actually was illegal under international law. It's illegal for an occupying power to sell off the assets of the country it's occupying. These laws, the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Regulations of 1907, exist because there is this unfortunate tendency among colonial powers to pillage the countries that they're occupying. So they have this clause that says pillage is forbidden. And they state very clearly that occupying powers are the guardians of the assets in the country that they are occupying. And they talk about the law of usufruct, which essentially means you can use it, but you can't sell it. I call it the house sitter's law, which is, you know, if you're house sitting for someone, you're allowed to eat the food in the fridge, but you're not allowed to sell the house and turn it into condos. Well, that's what they were doing. They thought that they could get away with it, and foreign investors thought that they could get away with it as well, when it seemed that they had a real political handle on the country that they were actually going to be able to install a pliant regime. But when the resistance grew and it became clear that they had a very, very tenuous hold on the country, investors got cold feet, insurance companies got cold feet, and the whole plan was put on hold. The other thing that happened is that the appointed politicians, Iraqi politicians on the governing council and in the ministries, had a meeting in October, and they realized that their political future would be finished if they went ahead with the privatization, if they sold off Iraq while the country was still under occupation. They had this meeting in October. I learned about it when I was there. It was never reported on at the time. And they decided unanimously that they would not participate in the privatization, that it had to wait until after elections. But at this point, it was clear that nationalism was on the rise, and if there were elections, Iraqis would not elect a neoliberal government, that they would elect a nationalist government that would definitely protect some of Iraq's assets, if not all of them. So this presented a real problem for the U.S. occupation, and this is where these little betrayals, these small sort of localized betrayals of democracy and freedom became generalized to the whole country. What happened was that after this meeting, at the beginning of November, Paul Bremer flew to Washington and had a meeting at the White House to talk about what they were going to do, because they were supposed to be having elections relatively soon. And they had promised, when they came to Iraq, Paul Wolfowitz said, the occupation will last around 6 months and then we'll have elections. They were supposed to hand over power directly to an elected Iraqi government. That was the deal. But it was clear that if that happened, all bets were going to be off, because things were spiraling out of control. So he emerged from this meeting, came back to Iraq, and announced that there weren't going to be elections, as promised. And they unveiled something that came to be called the November 15th plan. And the November 15th plan was unveiled on November the 15th, was that rather than have these elections, there would be an appointed interim government. They would also write a constitution that would govern this interim government. And they put a clause in the constitution that said that the interim government had to enforce all the laws that were written by the occupation. So it's clearly an attempt to call the country sovereign when it was not, and to undermine this promise that they would hand over power directly to an elected government. And that was the turning point, and that's when things started to go very, very wrong. That was last November. And in fact, last November was, and I don't think this is a coincidence, it was the bloodiest month since the end of the so-called war, That was the bloodiest month for American soldiers. They had 82 casualties that month. And I think it was in no small part because that was the central betrayal. That was the moment when it became absolutely clear that they did not mean it when they said that they were coming to Iraq to bring democracy and liberation. Many people never believed it, but there were still people who were holding out hope that they meant it. Then you started to see a very powerful pro-democracy movement spearheaded by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Paul Bremer, when he said that there couldn't be elections, he gave two reasons. He didn't say because we want to sell off the country and, you know, we know you won't let us do it. He had another reason. He said the security situation was too precarious. The country wasn't safe enough to hold elections. And he also said that there were no voter lists, so there was no way that they could hold elections. Now, many people pointed out, including Sistani, that they had lists through the Oil for Food program because all Iraqi families received food through the Oil for Food program, and they those lists could double as a census, could double as voter rolls. The other thing they pointed out is that yes, things were precarious security-wise, but that many countries in precarious security situations like Colombia or Kashmir are able to have elections. And Sistani called on the UN to do their own independent evaluation. This was in January. Because he believed that the UN would back him up. And he believed that if they looked at the situation, they would intervene and they would say, yes, Iraq can have elections. Unfortunately, and now we come to February, the UN sided with the U.S. occupation. And I believe this was the most culpable betrayal of all, because we expect nothing less of the countries that invaded Iraq, because we know why they invaded Iraq. And they've actually behaved fairly consistently. But the UN was called on to be the independent voice, to speak for the desire for self-determination, to live up to their charter and their duty. And they didn't. They didn't have the guts to do it. And they backed up this claim that Iraq was too dangerous, it was too dangerous to have elections, and that there were no voter rolls. We know this is a lie. We know this is a lie now because they're saying they can have elections in a security situation that is hundreds of times worse than it was 1 year ago. Not only that, but lo and behold, they're using the oil for food lists to have the elections. Those are their voter rolls. They haven't done a census. It's exactly the argument that was being made by Sistani last January when 100,000 people came into the streets of Baghdad, held peaceful demonstrations, and their chant was, yes, yes, elections, no, no, selections. They were betrayed, and more faith was lost. The best way to bring security to Iraq, I believe, is to somehow figure out a way to bring that sense of hope and possibility in the promise of freedom, in the possibility of democracy, back. And I believe it's our job to do that. And I believe that the groups who are here tonight, groups like Jubilee Iraq, are doing exactly that by demanding total debt cancellation and by and no structural enslavement to a structural adjustment program that is demanding, by the way, the exact same neoliberal policies that Paul Bremer imposed: more privatization, more layoffs, cuts to state subsidies. This is the work that is so crucial, the work of fighting the privatization of the country, and also going after the British companies and the American companies that are profiting off of the illegal sell-off of Iraq. Now, I said earlier that I don't think it's good enough to delight in the failures of our opponents. We do need to say, bring the troops home. But just saying that isn't good enough because it's too easy and it lets us off the hook. If we have a job to do, it's not just to cheer the resistance. It is to pry open those spaces for democracy and for nonviolent resistance that have been systematically closed through brutal repression in Iraq. We need to join Iraqis in their demands for genuine self-determination, the demands that they have faced so much repression for making. If Iraqis win that, if Iraqis win real democracy and real liberation, then the imperial dreams of our governments will genuinely be dashed. Because I believe that they actually can deal with a Middle East in chaos, violence, and even fascism. I don't think that that is the real threat to them. A far greater threat is a Middle East that has genuine self-government, that is genuinely free of them, free of their structural adjustment programs, free of their debt, free of dependence on their multinational corporations. So let's try to remember in the future, better than we have in the past, what we're actually fighting for, not only what we are fighting against. We should dream not only for Bush and Blair to fail, but for the Iraqi people to win, which means we have our work cut out for us, and despair is not an option. Thank you.